Hey everyone, it's R.R. Campbell, your host of the listener-supported R.R. Campbell Writescast, checking in before this episode begins to share some exciting news. My debut novel, Accounting for It All, is to be published with Nine Star Press in November of 2018. Accounting for It All is the story of adult film star turned accountant Robin Weathers, who must evade an IRS investigation into a money laundering scheme to which she was unwittingly a part. Oh, and the woman Robin's always considered to be the love of her life? Yeah, she's back in the picture, finally ready to try to make things work. For more about Accounting for It All, you can visit rrcampbellwrites.com/books. That's rrcampbellwrites.com/books. I look forward to sharing Robin's story with all of you in November 2018. All right, time for your regularly scheduled programming. Thanks for listening. We've all been there. We've got an idea for a novel that centers around a place, profession, or set of experiences with which we're not quite familiar. Or, perhaps, not familiar at all. Thorough research can help us bring those experiences or that setting to life if we're not in a position to have them ourselves or visit the location in question, but where can we turn for the research we so need? Hey there, I'm R.R. Campbell, and welcome to episode 34 of your listener-supported R.R. Campbell Writescast. In this episode, we'll explore the great many things we can do and the places to which we can turn when we need research to which we can anchor our novels in time, place, and person. Let's get right into it then, beginning with this qualifier. The kind of research we as writers have to do will depend greatly on the genre in which we're writing. Are we writing historical fiction? In which time period is it set? Are we going for sci-fi that's heavy on the sci? Which field exactly will we be relying on most to bring that science to life? Are we writing something contemporary but set in a place or featuring a character about whose profession we're not very knowledgeable? By now it's surely obvious that the emphasis of our research will vary immensely based on our answers to those questions, but even with that in mind, there are at least four different avenues we can explore to scrounge up answers to the questions we have. In this episode, we'll tackle each one of these in turn, but let's list them off first for the sake of context. The four general resources we'll discuss in depth in this episode are the internet, literature, interviews, and experience-based research. All four offer distinct advantages and disadvantages, which we'll explore as we cover each one. The internet, of course, is probably the easiest place to begin, given that it's more than likely the most accessible and first to come to mind when the question of research arises. And it's true, the internet puts far more information at our fingertips than many could have ever imagined possible even just 20 years ago. There are a few disadvantages to using the internet, though, especially when one considers anyone can post anything they'd like on it at any time. That is to say, there's no guarantee what we're reading is 100% accurate or coming from someone who's an expert in their field. We won't cover that further since most of us are probably pretty well aware of this by now, but one disadvantage of using the internet for research that I think many overlook is that its greatest advantage, namely the quantity of information, is also one of its greatest weaknesses. With so much information available, how do we know where to begin? The answer to that might depend on how familiar you already are with the subject matter you're searching, but for most of us, our search will begin with a visit to the good old Google machine. We get it, RR, you might be saying. Could you be any more obvious about all of this? If that's what you're thinking, I get it. But bear with me as we cover some of the basics. Just as when we're doing our research, we don't want to leave any stones unturned in this exploration of research itself. The easiest thing to do when using Google is to just type in some keywords and hit enter, right? I mean, who hasn't sat there and typed out the questions behind the greatest of life's mysteries just to see what the almighty Google spits back at us? One thing you might not realize about Google, however, is that the order in which you list the keywords can affect the material it delivers to you. Seriously, try this out right now if you're in a position to do so. Take three seemingly unrelated words like, I don't know, apricot, pants, and mouse, and run them through a Google search. Now take a second to get a general impression of the results provided before rearranging the same words into a different order in the search box. Now run that search again. You'll probably get some similar results when executing both searches, at least for the first few links anyway, But depending on the specific terms you used, as you scroll down the page, you might find there are some different links entirely, or that they're at least arranged in a different order when compared to the original search. Why is this important? Well, how many times have you, and be honest now, actually taken the time to scroll through a few different pages worth of results to find exactly what you're looking for? More often than not, you're likely using the first 2 to 3 results to guide your search the rest of the way. Well, what if those are paid results? Are they labeled as ads? How might that affect the direction of your research and, by extension, the direction your story ultimately takes? Simply swapping the order of your search terms might turn up the source you're looking for or prevent you from relying on one that has incomplete or inaccurate information. I definitely encourage you to try a few related searches before really diving deep into any given topic. Google is great for more than general searches too. If you haven't checked out Google Scholar, you might be missing out on academic level information that could further enrich your background at a given topic. Though only previews of some papers are available, the abstracts alone might be enough to get you headed down new avenues in your own investigation. Or, if you feel like a particular paper will be of use to you, you can pay for full access to the paper in its entirety. Of course, not all research needs to or should be academic. Sometimes we just need descriptions of or information about people, events, or places. Where places are concerned, wouldn't it be great if we could see a particular location while researching setting, all from the comfort of our homes? Well, we can. Don't forget, Google Maps is great not only for the ability to swoop in and check out the layout of a given city or town far from you, but you can use its Street View feature too, and I'll put this in air quotes, walk the streets themselves to check out storefronts, plant life, and what people are wearing. Granted, there are a handful of caveats to keep in mind when using this Street View feature. First of all, the images on Google Street View are taken at a particular moment in time. They're a snapshot that will paint a different picture of any given neighborhood depending on the time of day or year they depict, and also how long ago the images themselves were gathered. If the most up-to-date Google imagery of a particular street is from 2012, there's a chance that the storefront you're gazing at might have changed in recent years, or disappeared altogether. In other words, Google Street View, like most of these channels for research, are only part of what should be a robust research diet. It's important to use as many distinct methods as possible to make sure we're exploring a multitude of angles. As you're listening to this podcast, you might be thinking, okay, but whatever, we already know Google is great. And it is. But you're certainly right to point out that it's not the only place online we can go to do our research. For the more gotta-see-it learners, there are plenty of tutorials on almost any topic available over on YouTube. There you can learn how to knit or scuba dive or get involved with competitive eating or, hey, even pick up a writing tip or two from your favorite writerly YouTubers. Kind of like Google Maps, YouTube is also an awesome place to check out for walkthroughs of the cities in which you might like to write about but have never visited. Even if you can't find a walkthrough of a particular neighborhood, you may be able to find videos taken there in general and use those to pick up on the sights and sounds of the area. Through YouTube, you can also access TED Talks or videos from channels like Khan Academy to investigate specific topics or generally get inspired. And if you find a channel that really seems like it might speak to you and the research you're trying to do, don't forget to subscribe to them so you never miss out on new videos they might release as well. Aside from Google and YouTube, I'll mention Amazon now too, which may come as a bit of a surprise. My recommendation here isn't to simply head over there and buy books on the topics you're interested in researching, but rather to find those books on Amazon and then take advantage of the Look Inside feature for the book before choosing to purchase it or find it at your local library. Through the Look Inside feature, you can, first of all, get a feel for the book's table of contents, and two, in some cases, you can even find the answer to your question in the book's preview itself, which will save you a purchase or a visit to the library. Not that there's anything wrong with visiting your library, of course. You absolutely should when you can, but we'll have more on library usage later in the podcast. At any rate, I've found Amazon's Look Inside feature to be helpful for answering quick questions, but one disadvantage of it is that since you're only getting a preview, you may not be getting the full context for a given fact or argument as presented in the book itself. That is to say, you may find a page that confirms something you know or thought you knew, not realizing that the previous page, which in this case is not included in the preview, might indicate that the quote-unquote fact you are reading is actually a common misconception. Clearly, it's critical to treat Amazon's Look Inside feature, just like any of these research methods, as simply one venture in your greater research expedition. As we advance through this exploration of internet-based resources, some of you might be confused as to why I haven't yet covered Wikipedia. Well, rest easy. It's time to hop into a conversation on that now. I don't know about you, dear listeners, but as someone who was in middle school as the internet started to become more widely available, I was inundated with this idea that the internet is a wasteland of disinformation and outright falsities. Though these criticisms have, in some avenues, proven to be rather prescient, the one criticism of web-based research that has stuck with me is the old adage of never being allowed to use Wikipedia as a reliable source. Over the years, though, Wikipedia has tightened the ability for truly anyone to hop on and make long-lasting changes to a given page. Beyond that, I personally find that Wikipedia is a great place to start one's research before following up with the references listed on a given page itself. If you're not sure what I mean when I mention these references, what I'm describing are the little numbers you might see in superscript following certain sentences on a given Wikipedia article. These are the citations for the sentence in question, and there's a master list of citations listed under references at the bottom of every article. If you scroll down to the references section, you can find the original source from which the article, or at least that sentence of it, was pulled. Using those resources, then, you can double-check what Wikipedia has to say while also getting more familiar with information that's closer to the original source, which is always a plus. That about covers it for the major places most think of where online research is concerned, but let's not forget about the blogosphere or sites like Quora or other more specific professional forums where those with questions can head to send questions to folks who are subject matter experts in their fields. These have been a saving grace for me, especially when exploring some topics for my upcoming sci-fi release, Empathy: Imminent Dawn, which will be available in January 2019. If you're looking for an industry forum where professionals might be willing to answer questions, but don't know where to begin looking for where these forums are, might I suggest relying on our friend Google to direct you to them? Even a simple search for something like Farming Forum Question and Answer will provide results that can get you into forums on agriculture with a ton of questions, many with answers already provided. That brings me to my next point. If you do pursue these forums, definitely make sure to see whether anyone else has already asked that question, and, from there, if they received an answer. It's possible to save yourself time and save the responders some frustration by not asking a question that comes up constantly for them. If you're curious about something, someone else likely has been too, so be sure to explore a bit before casting your question out into the ether. If you do find that your question has already been answered, make sure to check the date on which it was answered too. The last thing you want to do is rely on outdated or outmoded information to support your research, so if you do see the most recent answer to a given question as a few years old, then it might, in fact, be worth asking that question again. If after looking for professional forums on a given topic you're still struggling to find anything, you can always consider checking out Reddit, which has some great forums on a seemingly unlimited number of topics where you can direct your questions. Clicker beware, however, many subreddits don't require that those responding be experts in order to provide an answer. That is to say, you could throw a question out there and receive a response from someone who might know even less than you do about the thing you're curious about. When using Reddit, be sure to check out the given subreddit's criteria for the provision of answers, or wait for a consensus to come rolling in before running off with the first answer you received as the one true response. Beyond forums like Quora and Reddit, you might consider using your social media networks to see if you have anyone among your friends and professional acquaintances who has knowledge of a given place or topic that you didn't know they had. For example, the sequel to Empathy: Imminent Dawn has several scenes that take place in Quebec and Costa Rica, neither of which are places I've visited myself. Knowing this, I sent out a tweet asking if anyone among my followers had any familiarity with Quebec or Canadian French in general. I was surprised and super thankful when a follower of mine directed me to a contact of theirs who's a native of Quebec. Not only that, the Quebec native has now become a beta reader for my chapters that take place there, and she's been incredibly helpful in making sure I bring that location and its language to life. Where Costa Rica was concerned, I saw on Facebook that an old college friend was doing a tour there for the Peace Corps. I reached out to her, and after some back and forth, I'm now putting together a list of questions about her experience that will help inform the scenes I write that take place in Costa Rica. You might be surprised at how willing people are to talk about and share their experiences and expertise. Based on my success in reaching out to people like this so far, I plan on contacting other friends and acquaintances to get their input on anything ranging from law to gardening to fencing. All you have to do is ask. The worst anyone can say is no. One final discussion point we'll examine for online research pertains to using Google Translate to help, you know, translate from one language to another. As a trained linguist and polyglot myself, I really appreciate the careful, deliberate inclusion of non-English words and phrases in contexts that may call for them. But please, for the love of all things holy, don't rely exclusively on Google Translate to be the end-all, be-all for your translation needs. Granted, Google Translate has come a long way in the last 5 years especially, and I was a near-daily user of it myself for the years prior to that. There are a number of tips and tricks you can use to ensure you're getting more accurate translations from it, but that could be a podcast unto itself, so we won't mire ourselves in all of that right now. If you are curious about these and would like more detail, don't hesitate to email me at rightscast@gmail.com. I'll try to steer you in the right direction from there. For the sake of this podcast, though, if you really want to include a foreign language in your manuscript, Google Translate's results can serve as an effective placeholder. But definitely run those translations by a native speaker in the context of your manuscript itself to make sure your translations read well and accurately represent your intentions. If you're working with a language that, to your knowledge, doesn't have any native speakers available in your area, you might consider reaching out to a nearby university's linguistics department to see if they're aware of any native-speaking resources in your area for a given language. You might be surprised with what they turn up. All right. We've spent plenty of time covering online resources, which I'm hopeful has left you with a few new insights into how to use them to your advantage. The internet, though, should be but one course of our multi-course resource meal, so with that in mind, let's turn our attention to books and other literature. Naturally, we covered books and literature a bit in the previous section, describing how Amazon's Look Inside feature and Google Scholar can help direct you to more primary sources for the information you seek. What do I mean by primary sources, you ask? Primary sources include literature or other artifacts written in or from the era being researched. For example, if you've written a novel set during the Industrial Revolution in Canada and you want the perspective of a textile worker from that time, you might seek out a journal written by someone of that background or turn to a newspaper published from that time that might feature articles about the conditions those workers endured. That all sounds fine and good, right? But how do you get your hands, or at least your eyes, on a primary source like that? Well, your library is a great place to start. Many libraries, especially those in larger cities, have digital archives of documents like these that you can search for the information you need. Beyond the library, you can always check out historical societies, museums, or a university's research archives as well. If you're unsure about how to get more information on or where to find these resources, your friendly local librarian will surely be more than willing to help direct you to them. Even if your local library itself doesn't have the resources you're looking for, they might be able to work with another library in their network to assist you. It never hurts to ask. Aside from primary sources, there are always works of fiction written more recently that report on an era gone by. These can be valuable as well, yes, though it's important to get varied perspectives from different authors when possible. Everyone brings a bias to the page, whether intentional or not, so reading nonfiction from multiple perspectives, like a collection of essays, for example, might be a good investment. Let's use an anecdote to demonstrate the importance of incorporating multiple perspectives in our research, regardless of the media we use to facilitate it. When researching for Accounting for It All, my novel about an adult film star turned accountant, I used a handful of different research methods. The most foundational research I did relied on two documentaries and a collection of essays, a primary source in this case, but later found out one of the documentaries I relied on was not generally viewed positively by those in the adult industry. As such, I made sure to evaluate the industry's criticisms of the documentary in order to avoid letting its missteps inform the manner in which I presented that world and the characters of mine that inhabit it. If I had just moved forward with only using that one documentary, which, generally speaking, are other great resources to turn to for your research, I could have landed myself in some serious hot water, as my perspective on those topics would have been shaped only by a source that itself has been considered flawed by many with firsthand knowledge of its subject matter. The moral here is this. Regardless of whether our information comes from the internet, a book, pamphlet, journal, newspaper, or even a face-to-face interview, we have to be in a position to examine the information as objectively as possible, trying to understand what bias the writer or speaker might have when we take in that information. Where speakers and interviews are concerned, these are another great avenue to pursue in order to sate one's research appetite. I've hinted at the use of interviews earlier when mentioning my research on Quebec and Costa Rica, which brings me to this point. You don't need to interview the person face-to-face in order to get valuable information from them. On the contrary, interviews by email or phone can work just as well, or are even better if your interviewee is in a remote location. That being said, face-to-face is probably the best way to make sure you have your source's undivided attention. Not only that, but instead of meeting them for a cup of coffee, have you considered trying to shadow them while they're on the job, doing the very thing that it is you'd like to learn more about? Back in episode 9 of the RightsCast, guest Kristen Oakley talked about how she spent time with the police department in northern Wisconsin to pick their brains while they were actively on the job. And she also cited collaborating with a physicist so that the two of them could take on a mutual project with expertise in both the world of physics and the world of fiction. Collaborating in this way essentially creates a situation where the participants can say, "With our powers combined, we are Captain Write-It," or something. If you're unsure where to find someone you can interview about a given topic, that's where the internet, books, and your libraries come into play. Can you find your way to the website of or get a telephone number for a professional organization near you? Are you able to contact your local university for subject matter experts in academia? Using those avenues to guide you to the person you ultimately interview can be invaluable, and I absolutely recommend giving it a try. Now we get to the fun stuff, or, well, hopefully fun stuff anyway. I'm talking now, of course, about experiential research, actually getting out into the world and doing yourself the thing that you'd like to learn about. Granted, this won't always be a possibility. Time, money, distance, and accessibility are all factors one has to consider before skydiving or starting an organic farm or deep-sea fishing, for a few examples. But it's through experiential research that we can get the most vivid details to support our writing. What's it really feel like to be plummeting toward the Earth at terminal velocity? How does it feel to plant a seed and watch it grow and harvest the end result months later? What does the sea sound like during a storm as you race back to shore before the waves lap over the side of your ship? These are questions we can have answered through the details others share in their own fiction or nonfiction writing, but there's something to be said for actually experiencing them ourselves. The old adage of writing what you know isn't perfect, but there's a reason it exists. Writing what we know allows us to bring unmatched authenticity to our characters, our plots, and our worlds. And authenticity is one thing that, by its very definition, cannot be faked. If you're unable to get out there and quote-unquote do the thing yourself, well, as we've covered over the course of this episode, there are plenty of other options out there to learn about these things too. All we have to do is be deliberate and honest in our research, and we can bring to life the people, places, and professions our works of fiction feature. And on that point too, with all this talk of research, let's not forget we're ultimately writing fiction. That is to say, we can work within the bounds of our readers' suspensions of disbelief to strike a balance between cold, hard facts and warmer, slightly softer facts, or however you want to put it. All right, that's all I've got on research for this 34th episode of your listener-supported R.R. Campbell RightsCast. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks as always to Wise Mentor Kristen Oakley, who supported the RightsCast at patreon.com/rightscast goes a long way into helping this show become self-sustaining. In exchange for her patronage, Kristen receives some great patron perks, including votes in listeners' choice polls and the yearly RightsCast awards. If you'd like to learn more about becoming a RightsCast patron, you can head over to patreon.com/rightscast. Coming up on the RightsCast, we'll have a new mini-series debuting on May 4th, 2018. Sione Ashleman will join me as the co-host for this Novel Approaches mini-series, which is all about preparing to write a new manuscript. We'll have 6 episodes coming out almost weekly over the course of 2 months, so be sure to tune in for those. In the meantime, you know how to get a hold of me. I'm RightsCast@gmail.com, and I am R.R. Campbell and RightsCast on Twitter. It'd be great to hear from you. Until May 4th, this is R.R. Campbell signing off. Write on and write well.